Okay, good evening, everybody. Before we start, I'd like to thank Frank Gaudio and his team from the IEASM, as well as our sponsors in the Hilti Foundation, for giving me the opportunity to talk about the work that's going on this fantastic little boat. As you can see, I hope, from the names on the screen, this isn't my excavation, and it's a complete team event. And I thank them all for giving me access to their work and their thoughts about this boat to sit alongside my own on it. And I'd also like to thank all of our colleagues from the Central Department for Underwater Antiquities and the staff at the Maritime Museum in Alexandria, which are both part of the Ministry of Tourism and Antiquities, and who are instrumental in helping our work there. So off we go. The image that you get from the archaeological evidence of Roman ships and boats is predominantly associated with the amphora-carrying merchant vessel. Indeed, the visibility of the merchant ship in the archaeological record has largely overshadowed the smaller boats, the fishing boats, the tugs, the lighters, the dredgers, the pleasure craft, and other multipurpose vessels that would have crowded ancient harbours and made them work. Largely, these would have been made in local shipyards with materials that are close at hand in tried and tested designs. So here we have this example of this mosaic from Rimini, and we can see what would likely have been a locally made tugboat. So that's this thing here, which is carefully shepherding a large freighter into the port past this lighthouse. Where another ship, which you can see just off to the side here, is sort of patiently awaiting its turn. It's an actual occurrence that would have been replayed countless times in the Portus Magnus of Alexandria. Fortunately, when we're looking at small ships and boats, rescue work in other large Roman harbours in recent years has gone some way to redress this imbalance, particularly in places such as Ostia, Pisa and Naples, and of course in Yenikapa in Istanbul for the Byzantine period. Now, unsurprisingly then, if we're interested in looking for smaller boats, then it's in the sediments of harbours that we need to look. It's here that small boats were often discarded and abandoned at the end of their working lives in infrequently used and often silty areas of the port, or else they were wrecked in storm events and rapidly buried, or deliberately sunk and reused in harbour infrastructure. But this isn't the picture entirely for J3. Which, as I hope to demonstrate in this seminar, is related more closely to the world of long-distance trade and exchange than to the small world of the Portus Magnus, where it was found. J3 is, in all probability, an incredibly rare example of a ship's boat. So in terms of this mosaic that we're looking at, it's this little vessel here that's being trailed behind the larger merchant ship rather than the local tugboat, even though, as I hope to show you, both of them can do similar things in terms of moving boats around harbours. Now, prior to its discovery, such vessels, which are relatively commonplace in the archaeological record and also in the literature from the period, are seldom found, simply because in the event of a shipwreck, the ship's boat would have been used as a lifeboat, as the crew and the passengers would have abandoned the stricken vessel, which is one of the things you can see here. In this passage from a shipwreck that occurred in Paul's journey to Rome. So that's the one at the bottom that's published in Acts. It's clear in this case that the ship's boat had been brought aboard the larger vessel, perhaps because of the storm. But there's plenty of literary evidence and also artistic evidence, like you can see here, of the ship's boat being trailed behind. And that's what you can see in the quote from Statius above. Here, this is a prayer to wish Mesias Kayla a safe voyage aboard an Alexandrian grain ship. And Statius in this prayer goes through a whole sequence of actions through this, which this vessel is made ready to set sail. And these include the instructions that you see on the screen to make fast the skiff that will follow behind. Also, in the event that the ship's boat does go down with the main ship, we're then reliant upon it entering into the archaeological records. So it typically being covered by the main wreck or debris from it. And then from maritime archaeologists to recognize the likely few disarticulated pieces of plank as being part of something different from that of the larger merchant ship. So overall, I think that ships' boats aren't easy to find or to recognize in the archaeological record. J3, though, was discovered completely buried in the sediments of the Portus Magnus. It's out in the middle of a harbour, so it's in the Royal Harbour, as you can see here. There were no telltale timbers sticking out from the sediments or mounds of debris on the surface that might have hinted at its presence. And instead, it took a new phase of geophysical survey in the Eastern Port by the IASM, using a new parametric shallow multi-beam surveying instrument, of which there's a picture both of the output results from this and also the vessel that did it. While Frank Goddio and his team had previously done sub-bottom profiling work across the Portus Magnus previously, the new equipment enabled us to get a much more detailed look into the sediments. In order to ground truth what it was that Frank and the team were looking at, he decided to excavate this particular site to look at this small boat-shaped anomaly in the data. That appeared to be around 5 meters long by about 2.5 meters wide. So it's a very small boat. Now, as will become apparent from this, obviously we found what we were looking for in this term of the this small little boat in J that is termed J3. So J3 was excavated during the summer mission in the Portus Magnus in 2018. It's currently being written up by a team from the IASM and the University of Oxford. And here on the screen, you can see Alexander Beloff and David Honoré excavating the boat. And these are the same colleagues who are also responsible for writing up its nautical architecture. As far as progress goes, we've nearly finished the first draft of the monograph, which will then be sent out to peer review. And we hope to have it published towards the end of 2022, ideally. So consequently, what I'm presenting here is our initial interpretations of this little vessel. So this is what it looks like. And as you can see from this photo mosaic, is its remarkable level of preservation, especially on its port side, where there's a complete section of the boat from the keel, which is down here, through to the guardrail up here. So particularly on this side of the boat. And of particular interest is the transom, which is this squared off bit at the back of the boat, and also the two rowing benches here and here, or thwarts, as they're also known, which come complete with the thole pins against which the oars would have pivoted. There's one here, there's one here, and there's one up here. And then there's also a now missing third rowing bench here. What you can also see in this image is the large disassembled iron anchor. So that's this thing here, and that's its shank and its stock there. And the stock obviously has been disassembled from the anchor and placed neatly next to the shank. Again, I'll return to the significance of this for its interpretation of the function of the boat and its particular or potential region of origin a bit later in this seminar. But first, though, I think it probably would be useful to give a brief insight into elements of J3's nautical architecture to demonstrate its method of construction and the care also with which its timbers were selected for their mechanical properties. So we can start with the keel. I think it's at this point good to have a bit of sort of semi-hardcore nautical architecture in this. So the keel itself is made from ash and is preserved for a length of 4.43 meters. Now, in this, ash is a particularly apt choice of wood. It's a hardwood that also can be bent quite readily. And this is what would be needed in a small boat where there's a strong degree of curvature towards what we think is the bow. So as you can see in this image, particularly in the section of it here, it's roughly rectangular in section. And from the schematic diagram, you can see that the inner edges of the first line of hull planks were set flush against the side of the keel and fastened with closely set mortise and tenon joints. I should say here that the wood identification was done by Tina Rishafanas from the Institute of Archaeology and Alexander Beloff from the IASM, who Alex is currently out in Alexandria at the moment working on more wood samples from this boat and lots of the others that have been excavated. So turning now to the planking, as is common in Roman period vessels, while the keel of the boat may have been in a hardwood, its planking was made from softwood. In this case, it's pine. And these were thin, very thin boards. They're about 8 millimeters thick. And we have 14 of them preserved on the port side, with only about 6 on the starboard side. They're roughly of the same width in this part of the boat, about 9 to 10 centimeters. And this tapers to 6 to 7 centimeters towards the end of the vessel. So the planks themselves are between 3 and 4.5 meters long. And as you can see in this, this reconstruction, every single plank or every single strake is an individual plank. In terms of its construction then, J3 is carvel built, which means that the lines of the strakes are set flush against each other to create a smooth outer hull. They're fastened using mortise and tenon joints, with the tenons being made from hornbeam, which is a finely textured, dense hardwood that's resistant to splitting. And you can see one of the tenons here. These are rectangular, roughly 4.6 centimeters long, 3.3 centimeters wide, and about 2 millimeters thick on average. The tenons fitted tightly into their corresponding mortises and were secured by tapering pegs, which were also of hornbeam. And these have a sort of average diameter of 5 millimeters. The pegs go through the thickness of the planking and were inserted from the outside of the hull. The gunwale of J3 is the last of the lines of planks. It's thicker than all the others and projects significantly outboard. Now, the purpose of this is to protect the boat from damage during berthing or as it goes alongside other boats, but it would also have added considerably to the stiffening of the hull. Now, unlike the softwood pine planks, the gunwale was made of elm, as it's a tough hardwood that's not prone to splitting and also has a good surface hardness. So it could take the wear and tear that's associated with the life of a little boat like this. But also, given the shape of the boat, elm is again a good choice for the gunwale because it can be bent into shape. Directly over the top of the gunwale is the guardrail, which was made from cypress. And cypress is a durable, moderately strong wood that has a high surface hardness and could also take a really good polish. Now, these qualities make it particularly a suitable timber for a guardrail. It combines the ability to resist wear and tear again, while also being potentially decorative. The guardrail is installed directly over the top of the frames, which, like the keel, is also made of ash. And you can see all of this going on again in this reconstruction. In the central area of the guardrail, two thole pins were inserted with another one further forward. So you can see here the schematic drawing of the insertion of the thole pins. These are made of hornbeam, which is an unusual shipbuilding timber, but it's a tough hardwood that can take a high surface polish. And this high surface polish is quite useful because it would reduce the friction between the thole pin and its oar. Now, while this might be something of a marginal gain, it demonstrates the care with which the timber species were selected for J3. Associated with the thole pins are the two remaining pine thwarts. And these are the rowing benches, as I said. And then again, there's also the remains of a now missing third rowing bench, which is associated with the third thole pin. As you can also see here in this image, along the line of the keel, was also a mast step. It's this here with the hole for the mast, which is overlain by the anchor. This would obviously indicate, therefore, that J3 could be propelled by sail as well as oars, but there was no evidence for a mast in the excavation, and the only rigging elements that were discovered were of a size that would have been unnecessary for the rig of a small boat. Here, though, I think it should be noted that no oars were found either. But it's more likely that J3 was under oar power at the time of its loss, as oars would obviously have offered a greater ease of manoeuvrability in the confined spaces of a crowded harbour. Now, when wrecking, these oars would have floated away during the accident, or perhaps later as their binding cords rotted away, whereas the hull itself remains pinned to the bottom of the harbour through the weight of the anchor that it was transporting. The weight of the anchor seems to have pushed the port side of the boat deeper into the sediment, which obviously results in the better preservation of this side of the vessel. Okay, so much for nautical architecture. What can we see? I suppose at the stern of the vessel, next to the transom, is a platform on which the helmsman would have stood. And if we look at this image of a tugboat from the Isla Sacra in Ostia, this could also be something. It's got three rowers like ours. It's got a fairly squared off transom stern, you know, so does it have a steering oar with it? Well, we don't actually have any evidence for this. And its presence on J3 is rather conjectural, or perhaps even unlikely, given the small size of the platform. So we're not necessarily dealing with something quite this large. But when we start to discuss Roman boats with a transom and use the types of artistic evidence that you can see here on the screen, we wander into a surprisingly acrimonious debate in the literature about which way they go. Either pointy end first, as you can see here in this ceramic plaque, or a flat end first, transom end first, as you can perhaps see here in this mosaic of a fishing boat from Utica in Tunisia. As you can see, both of these are rowing boats with transom ends. They're a type which is referred to in the literature as an araya, thanks to this mosaic here from the frigidarium of the bathhouse of the House of the Muses in Altiboris. It's a fantastic mosaic which has lots of ships being depicted on it with their names associated with it. So as you can see here, araya. Equally, the bundles that you can see here, there's here and here. Now, these are typically interpreted as fishing nets, which in conjunction with the mosaics such as that from Utica, this has resulted in the idea that this type of small boat was used for fishing. And it's also resulted in the idea that this type of small boat goes transom end first, so flat end first. While several depictions of boats with transoms in ancient art are associated with fishing, there are examples that aren't, which has led to some authors broadening the definition of the horaea. For example, this is the Torlonia relief that you can see here, and it depicts two small boats. So we can see one here and another one over here. These are associated with larger merchant ships, and both of the small boats have transoms. Now, it's been argued that these are carefully and accurately depicted. And what they're showing is that ships' boats can have a transom bow so that they can nose up to wharfs easily, which is certainly the case with what seems to be being portrayed with this particular vessel here. Now, if we're going to be pedantic about this, I suppose the first issue is whether these boats should be called horaea, particularly when the ancient literature would suggest that ships' boats would have been known by specific terms, such as a lembus, a scaphus, and a phacalis. And these are seen in Plautus, Caesar, Statius, and so on. But we'll see. Now, our particular contribution to this debate, and where J3 comes in really handy, is that it provides explicit archaeological evidence of the rowing system itself and the position of the thole pins and the rowing benches. So consequently, J3 demonstrates the position of three lines of rowers. So you've got a rower here, pulling on an oar here, a rower here with an oar here, and a rower here, with an oar here. All of whom therefore sit with their backs towards the pointed end of the vessel. The stroke of the oars would thus propel the boat forwards, with the fine voluted end as the bow and the transom at the stern. So this is what's depicted on both the Rimini ship mosaic and in the plaque from the Isola Sacra. Now, the second way into this debate comes from the digital reconstruction of this model, which is being, of this ship, boat, sorry, which is being undertaken by Nesrin El Ghali. Nesrin's using a powerful nautical architecture program called Orca 3D, which is used to design and test modern ships and boats to understand their working parameters. It's effectively a design program. At present, though, she's having great difficulty in persuading the software that the boat should go transom end first. And these results are also echoed in another set of computer tests for a transom ended boat from Naples, which demonstrated that it's not an ideal design for a bow, particularly in waves. So consequently, what we would suggest is that from the surviving archaeological evidence, J3 is a transom sterned boat, and it goes, as you might expect, pointy end first. But this doesn't mean that all boats of this type in the Mediterranean were arranged in this manner. There's the sheer uncertainty in the iconographic record and the debate surrounding it means that we simply cannot present this as any sort of hard and fast rule. It's just what it seems to suggest for J3. And equally, it's clear that if you really wanted to, you could probably row J3 in either direction. Finally then, before we move on from the boat and its excavation towards its interpretation, we just need to say a little more about its dating. Now, unfortunately, we don't have high precision radiocarbon, and instead are dating it at this moment using the ceramic evidence from the material recovered in context with the boat during excavation. This was undertaken by IAASM ceramicist Catherine Gratteloup, and it's her work here. The ceramics, which were not part of a cargo, were not part of a cargo from J3, or even were on J3 at the time of its sinking, these would have been washed into the boat during its incorporation into the harbour floor. The ceramics, though, do come from sealed archaeological contexts associated with J3, next to the hull, and in the excavations closely around it. And consequently, they do provide us with a group with which we can consider a broad date range into which the sinking and burial of the vessel should be fitted. It should be noted, however, that the majority of the assemblage is abraded and shows evidence of marine concretion that would indicate that it wasn't rapidly buried within the sealed contexts. Now, this temporal lag in becoming incorporated will obviously result in relatively mixed and potentially long-lived assemblages. The diagnostic pottery, however, dates are largely consistent, even if they do have a relatively large date range, from early Roman Alexandria and its Augustan beginnings through to about the 3rd century AD. Given that we've seen small boats with transoms used for fishing and as tugboats and as also as ship's boats in the archaeological record, well, in the artistic record, I suppose, what makes us believe that J3 is related to the ship's boat? For this, we need to think about what a ship's boat is and does for an ancient merchant ship, and then go back and revisit the large anchor that we found disassembled in its hull and the types of wood species that the boat was made from. Now, what you're looking at is perhaps one of the most famous depictions of a merchant ship from antiquity, and it's this graffito of the ship Europa from Pompeii, which clearly depicts at the back here a small little boat. Perhaps, and there is debate about this in the record, with a crew member sat in it. We know this from the literary sources that often a crew member is stationed in the ship's boat. And it's fixed here by a cable to the stern of the vessel. Interestingly, you can see that it is perhaps being towed transom first with the voluted bow at this end, but also with what has been depicted here as what looks like a steering oar, which we don't have any evidence for with J3. So from the orations of Demosthenes, for example, through to an epistle of Paulus of Nola, a ship's boats feature occasionally in the literature of travel. Most particularly, they appear in tales of merchants, of shipwreck, and of escaping from danger. And these go across the whole long history of the classical world. So for a merchant ship like the Europa, a small auxiliary boat was a practical necessity. They would have been used to carry out a whole range of different tasks. These would have included supplying the ship with food and water, perhaps during the voyage, when the ship was simply calling into a port to revictual, or when it was at anchor waiting for a space at the quayside to unload. You could also use them for transporting passengers and crew to and from the shore, or to move the ship, particularly when there's no wind, or when it's operating in the confined conditions, such as inside a harbour. Now, it's in this latter case where we can see a sort of tangible link between the ways in which a ship's boats would have been used in ancient seafaring and the archaeological remains that we have from J3. So notably, we have a small boat with a large anchor found within the confines of a port basin. And for me, this is sufficient to examine the possibility that J3 could have sunk while carrying out work associated with this anchor. So while it might seem self-evident from this image, particularly the top one, it has to be said that the anchor that J3 was carrying was not used to anchor it. It's a plainly ship-sized anchor rather than a boat-sized one. Unfortunately, however, we didn't find any evidence for a small anchor during the excavations of J3 that would have been its own anchor, but it also may well be that, like lots of small ships boats documented during the Age of Sail, that J3 was never equipped with one. So turning first to the anchor itself, the morphology of the curved arms would indicate that it most closely resembles Greg Vitruba's lunate anchor form, which is part of an iron anchor typology that he developed here in Oxford for his DPhil. The arms of the anchor, which are here, you can see it's quite heavily concreted, but from this drawing, but as you can see, they gently narrow towards what appears to be simple pointed tips. Equally, both of the arms are different lengths, and this would indicate that one of the original tips broke during its use at some point. They're both roughly chisel shaped as well. Now, although it's heavily concreted, the shank of the anchor from J3 appears to project beyond the crown. That's this little bit here. This is what's called the crown stub, and it's likely to have ended in a crown ring, which would have gone around here, which is now corroded away. The purpose of this was to attach a trip rope and a buoy that would have been tied to it. And this buoy would have marked the position of the anchor and would have facilitated its safe removal from the seabed. Now, the removal of an anchor with a trip buoy is often done through the use of a ship's boat. The crew row out to the buoy and then haul on the attached rope to remove the arm from its set. So from the form of the arms, the stock and its fitting aperture at the top of the shank, and also the crown, we can use all of these different elements of the anchor to propose a relative date for the one from J3. So firstly, the lunate form of the arms of the anchor would suggest that it was from the Roman period, between the early and middle imperial periods. And this could be further narrowed down due to a consideration of the rectangular form of the stock and its aperture in the shank. So this is the rectangular form here, and this is the aperture. Um, This head type is in use from at least the 2nd century BC until the 5th century AD. So a very broad range for that particular element. But then finally, the presence of the crown stub down here and probably the crown ring would suggest a date between the 2nd century BC and the 2nd century AD. So for our anchor then, I think what we're likely looking at is a date from the Augustan period to the 2nd century AD. Now, it should also be noted that similar iron anchors have also been found off Alexandria in two of the anchorages located about 500 metres north of the entrance to the Eastern Harbour and Kite Bay Fort. And there's another example a little further along the coast on the El Hassan Reef, which is located 500 metres northeast of the promontory of Cape Lochias. Now, from a consideration of these anchors, it suggested that the example from J3 is most closely paralleled by those dating from the early to mid Roman imperial periods, that is, prior to the end of the 2nd century AD. Now, for me, at least, comfortingly, this all fits well with the ceramics excavated from the boat. When we look at anchors in the ancient world, there's a very broad correlation between the size of the anchor and the carrying capacity of the ship on which they're found. For example, morphologically similar anchors to that from J3 have been found on the Drummond E and the Lardier 4 shipwrecks. Drummond E was suggested to have been a ship around 16 metres long, 5 to 6 metres wide, and carrying a cargo of about 40 tonnes. And this has an anchor of about 1.65 metres long, whereas Lardier 4 was slightly smaller and had a slightly smaller anchor. So it is about 1.46 metres long. So consequently, it can safely be assumed, I think, that in the ancient world, as in the Age of Sail, where we have much better documentation, the size of the anchor relates to the size of the ship. And it can also be safely assumed that an anchor of the size found on J3 would normally not be recovered from a small boat. So the approximate size of the vessel, we can hopefully get at that by plotting the dimensions of the anchor on Vitruva's distribution graph of well-preserved iron anchors from shipwrecks of known sizes, which is what you can see here on the screen. This uses a combination of the total length of the anchor in centimetres plotted against the cross-to-arm end length, which for J3 is 276 centimetres and 87 centimetres for the unbroken arm of the anchor. So what this kind of indicates is when you plot all of this out, it comes to about there, and would indicate that it would have come from a ship around 20 to 25 metres long with a carrying capacity of maybe 60 to 100 tonnes, something like that. These are roughly the dimensions of a kind of standard-sized freighter, I think, from the Roman period. We can now turn to the issue of where the small boat came from. And in the introduction to this seminar, I suggested that the majority of small boats would be made in local shipyards, which could suggest that J3 was a native Alexandrian vessel. Its interpretation as a ship's boat, however, brings this into question and raises the possibility that it was made somewhere else. So how can we resolve this? Now, an initial way in could be with the anchor again. And the idea that morphologically similar anchors to that found in J3 and where they're distributed. And this is simply because the research into ancient anchors has demonstrated that there are clear regional patterns to the distribution of different anchor types. And as we might expect, different regions at different times construct typologically different types of anchor. On the screen here, you can see the distribution of other examples of lunate anchors, which have a clear Western Mediterranean distribution. Now, added to this should also be the other similar anchors found in the anchorages off Alexandria, which were published after Greg Vitruba created this map for his DPhil. So consequently, this not only provides us with a possible home region for the production of this anchor, but also a potential trade route between the Western Mediterranean and Alexandria. J3 sank carrying an anchor, probably made in the Western Mediterranean then. But what about J3 itself? Where do we think it was made? It could, for example, have been made in Alexandria and used not as a ship's boat, but as a general purpose working vessel within the harbour. We can get some way towards identifying its production region, however, through an examination of the wood species with which it was made. Now, what's notable from the outset is that the small boat wasn't constructed in native Egyptian woods. Therefore, it could easily be suggested that this could imply that it wasn't of Egyptian origin. But this is far from certain, given its discovery in Alexandria, coupled with the long-standing and well-developed timber economy of Egypt that would have been centered on the Portus Magnus. In the Ptolemaic period, Alexandria sat at the center of an Eastern Mediterranean empire in which timber for its warships was a vital strategic resource. The importance of securing territory with heavily forested hinterlands continued to be an important part of Ptolemaic foreign policy through to the final years of the dynasty, with Strabo noting that Antony assigned the cities of Sidra and Hamaxia in Cilicia to Cleopatra VII due to them being, and I quote, capable of furnishing materials for the construction of her fleet. So consequently, within this, we can start to build up a picture of regional timber supply in the Ptolemaic period. And a similar picture comes from the wider Mediterranean during the Roman period, with Theophrastus, for example, stating that timber imports into Greece came from Macedon, from Pontus, and from the river Rhindacos. It's also been suggested archaeologically from the palynological and the xylological studies undertaken in the harbour sediments and the ship timbers from various sites along the Tyrrhenian coast. So when taken together, this evidence implies that the trade in timber was undertaken on a local basis if there were good supplies nearby, and regionally when they were not. Wood is generally uneconomical to import from distance unless it was an exotic or prized species that needed to make statements of wealth and luxury. Now, given this pattern, it's notable and not entirely unexpected that there are also similar patterns that are observable regionally in the use of wood in shipbuilding around the Mediterranean. While timber resources around the region are generally similar, and I'll look, if we look here, in the map, let's just go back, in this map of forest species. What more sort of local differences can be seen that can be sort of teased out from the evidence? And these local sources are essentially they reflect choices that are made based upon the availability of resources, based upon shipbuilding traditions and how these change with time. So consequently, it's possible that this kind of observation could be used to suggest a provenance for J3 to a particular construction region based upon its range of timbers and the extent to which they were used, which is where this image comes in. So while J3 is built in the very typical Roman style of using hardwoods for the keel and frames and softwoods for the planking, the combination of the timbers used is significant. Firstly, there's the use of cypress for the cap rail and the beams of the stern platform of the boat. And it's notable that it's been suggested in the literature that this timber isn't used for shipbuilding in the Eastern Mediterranean until the late Roman or Byzantine period. It's also conspicuously absent as a ship timber in the wrecks from southern France. So consequently, the use of cypress in J3 would perhaps point towards an origin somewhere in the Tyrrhenian Sea region, where it's seen in ships and boats from Naples, Pisa, and Ostia. The second element that links the construction of J3 to this coastline is its extensive use of ash as timber for the keel and for the frames of the vessel, as well as for its transom. Ash was not a preferred material for the construction of the axial structure in general, and is rare from ships originating from the Eastern Mediterranean. Similarly, the wrecks from the south of France, ash is utilized in a similar way to that in the Eastern Mediterranean. It's not used consistently as a main shipbuilding timber, but it's in the vessels of the Tyrrhenian coast where ash is used more consistently. And it's used in ships from Pisa, from Naples, and from Ostia. So while ash is an unusual choice of wood for the keel of J3, it's entirely understandable given its mechanical properties and notably its surface hardness and its high elasticity. In combination with its use in the frames, this would have allowed the creation of a strong axial structure for the vessel with the necessary bends to create the shape of this small boat. Just going to press. Altogether then, the evidence points towards the interpretation of J3 as a boat made somewhere on the coast of the Tyrrhenian Sea, which sank carrying a large anchor that was also likely made in the region. This would suggest that J3 was indeed a ship's boat. And it's evidence that would seem to fit with the picture that we get from Papyrus Bingen 77, for example, which records the arrival of a ship on the Ostia-Alexandria route. This large vessel would have returned to Italy, taking grain and luxuries from the east to the heart of the Roman Empire. J3 most likely reached the Portus Magnus either aboard or towed behind one of these trading vessels. And based on the size of the anchor, and assuming that the anchor that we have is the main one from the ship, it's possible that the ship that it arrived on was not one of the largest super freighters of the Alexandrian grain fleet that we hear about in literature, but instead J3's mothership was an average-sized trading vessel of a form that would have been very familiar in the larger Mediterranean mercantile harbours. But what of its loss? Can we say anything more about that? Now, it's perhaps significant for the overall interpretation of J3 to note the uneven lengths of the arms of the anchor, which would suggest that at least the port tip had broken at some point in antiquity. Now, this may well have required the removal from its vessel for repairs and may perhaps form a reason for its final location on J3. We can imagine a scenario where the anchor broke while the boat crew were trying to remove it from its set in the rocky anchorages off Alexandria's Portus Magnus. This would have resulted in the need for repairs on land and its final voyage neatly disassembled and stowed in J3 when disaster struck as it was rowed across the harbour in the shadow of Antirrhodos Island. Whatever accident befell it, the weight of the anchor shifted to the port side of the vessel, dooming it, but then pressed this side of the boat into the soft harbour clays, so preserving it for us. Now, finally, J3 also says something about the changes that are taking place in the Royal Harbour of Antirrhodos in the Roman period. And we've visited this island several times during the course of this seminar series. So we know that that Strabo, who visited the city, provides us with an eyewitness account. And contained within this is his description of the island of Antirrhodos as the private property of kings, which has both a royal palace and a small harbour. Now, it's here in these waters that J3 was discovered. So consequently, this small boat can be set alongside other finds from the excavations in the harbour basin. And together they allow us to say a little more about the development of this region of the Portus Magnus and its transition from a harbour associated with the Ptolemaic Royal Palace into part of the great commercial infrastructure of the Portus Magnus. A second shipwreck was also excavated by the IEASM in the Royal Harbour. This was the remains of a large commercial freighter, dated from around the first century to the beginning of the second century AD. This one was roughly 31 metres in length, 11 metres wide. It had a cargo capacity of around 250 to 260 tonnes. So much larger than the boat that would have used the anchor from J3. The Antirrhodos ship, therefore, would have been one of the larger vessels in the port. Now, the wood used in its construction included a piece of native Egyptian timber and other species that could have been sourced in the East Mediterranean. Coupled with this are the construction details that are regionally specific and indicate that this was perhaps an Egyptian vessel, or certainly one that was from the Eastern Mediterranean and repaired in Egypt. Oops, go back. So together, the Antirrhodos Island wreck demonstrates that the former Royal Harbour had undergone something of a transformation in the years of the early Roman Empire, and it was being used as a commercial harbour for ships coming from Italy and for local vessels. And we can see a similar pattern of regional and longer distance seafaring in the remains of complete and broken amphora that abounded in the excavations of these shipwrecks. These range from Cnidian amphora, dating from the second half of the first century BC, with the majority of the evidence coming from the second into the fourth century AD, with imports from the Aegean, Asia Minor, North Africa, and the Eastern Mediterranean. So notably, given the origin and date of J3, there's also evidence for italic imports in the form of mortaria and fine wares dating from the mid-first to the third century AD. Intriguingly, the excavation of J3 also brought to light these elements over here, these parts of pulley block and a sheave. Now, these are of a size that wouldn't have been compatible with the rig of a small boat like J3. And while they could have been lost in accidents from other large commercial sailing ships, we should also bear in mind that an Africana 2A amphora would have had a capacity of about 68 litres and would have weighed around 82, 83 kilograms in total, which would have made it very difficult to handle by a single stevedore without some sort of hoist or crane. So there's evidence for the expansion of the quayside during the first decades of Roman control, and this would have provided larger expanses of wharfage where the ships could tie up to. Perhaps as part of these redevelopments, we may also envisage the construction of cranes and other lifting devices to aid in the unloading and loading of the ships that would have crowded the quayside at this time. J3 then is but a small, but I'd say highly illustrative symptom of the wider changes affecting the Portus Magnus in the Roman period, which Frank Gaudio will talk about in his large lecture on the entire harbour area at the end of this term. What it does is it speaks of long distance commercial contact between Italy and Alexandria, and its fine spot in the former royal port talks about the increasing dominance of commerce that's also seen in the extensive developments on the western side of the port at this time. The significance of the discovery of a small ship's boat also needs to be reiterated. At the beginning of this seminar, I talked about the overwhelming disparity in the archaeological record towards large trading ships and the lack of smaller craft. J3 consequently reminds us of the vital role that such small vessels would have played in harbours all around the Roman world, as fishing boats, as tugboats, as lighters, and other general harbour craft, as well as being towed behind larger trading ships in the way that brought J3 to Egypt's shores. A hint of this can be seen in the quote from Synesius of Cyrene that's on the screen, and his description of a bustling harbourscape full of ships and boats of all sizes. Together, they helped to make Roman Alexandria, as Strabo saw it, the greatest emporium in the whole world. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Damien. That was wonderfully clear, remarkably detailed and insightful view into what a small boat like that can tell us about the working lives of harbours and the ships they're attached to. I've got loads of questions, but how heavy is that anchor? It was what, 2.76 meters long, iron with its stock. That's going to weigh quite a bit, isn't it?
Yeah, that's one of the things that we want to calculate. At the moment, it's still underwater, so we've never lifted it. We'd need to do that to do it properly. But I've tried to do some rough calculations based upon the weight of iron and the amount there is. But at the moment, I'm not entirely confident about my abilities with maths in this area. So I'm going with relatively heavy.
Okay. I'm wondering really whether anchors like that and larger on big ships actually themselves needed a pulley or some kind of mechanical device to help raise them. Could you have raised it from the small boat, or did you have to raise it from the large boat and then transfer it down into the small boat, as it were?
The way that we can get at this is from the literature from the Age of Sail, which is much more detailed, obviously, than the Roman literature. And there, the kind of the use of anchors is quite nicely set out. So one of the ways that you can have a capstan that raises the anchor. And I certainly think on some of the larger Roman merchant ships, this is what's happening. Whereas on your medium-sized vessels with anchors that aren't necessarily as heavy, that's where the ship's boat comes in. So you anchor it, and then the ship's boat rows out, and you can pull it onto the ship's boat and then sail back. Equally, you can use the anchor to move the ship's boat around the harbour. So you can put the anchor into the boat, the boat goes to where you want to do it, and then you throw the anchor overboard, and the ship drags itself towards the anchor, and then you repeat the process. So there's a whole series of things that small boats can do with anchors in ports. And I think we don't necessarily think about that too much when we're thinking about Roman harbours.
Hmm. I found your general argument that it's probably Western Mediterranean that was quite persuasive. But with the distribution of the anchors, those lunate anchors, your sample size is not terribly large. Yeah. And yeah. To what extent is that an investigation or publication bias that most of them are Italy and so on?
I think there is a certain amount of that that's going on within it. Obviously, the greater areas of investigation have a greater concentration of anchors, quite. So it is almost, it's a result of the kind of the shipwreck distribution map as well. So you have lots of the problems that are inherent with that coming up in this. What I would say is that Greg Vitruva's study of the anchors, you know, he looked at 1,500 published anchors from the, you know, as many of them as he could. And they do actually show quite distinct regional distribution patterns across all of his different ones, and also temporal patterns as well. So I do think there is something going on there that is purely beyond, you know, where we find everything.
Mm-hmm. I'll throw the interrogation open to the floor. I'm sure people have questions, so do raise your electronic Zoom hand. But if people are still thinking of questions, I just wanted to follow up with, I mean, you showed us that this is probably the type that appears on the Altheburus mosaic as a Horaea. Is it helpful to use the ancient names, or does that lead us down various avenues of presupposition, rather like names of rooms in Roman houses?
To a certain extent, it does. There's a whole literature on whether you should call this a Horaea or not, and the alternative names for it. And there are authors out there with surprisingly vitriolic opinions about the whole thing. So I use the term with a great deal of with many caveats, I suppose. You know, as far as I'm concerned, it's just a small boat. Whether we call it a skiffus or a Horaea, yeah, it's a small boat.
Mm-hmm. Questions?
I
still no electronic hands that I can see, but tell me if I've missed something. What other similar finds do we know of? I mean, are there excavated comparanda, or is this the first one? You showed us lots of iconography about these things, but have we got other excavated ships, boats?
The number of ships, boats that we have is incredibly small. Simply because of the difficulty of finding them, you know, they turn into a lifeboat. And so consequently, from the archaeological records, you know, there's hints of a couple. It's in harbours where you get much more evidence of small boats being discovered. And Giulio Boetto has amassed an extensive set of material that look at these small boats in Roman harbours. And they, you know, there's a whole series of different functions that they do. But in terms of a small ship's boat, I don't think that there are that many out there.
So this is more.
I mean,
more
Julia might tell me I'm wrong at this point, but. There was a question in the chat. Oh, there is Julia.
Yeah. Are you going to tell him he's wrong? Ciao.
Hello, hello to everybody. Yes, I have some questions, but okay, I can.
Please, far away.
So thank you very much for this presentation. It's very interesting. And I completely agree with you about the different type of sheep, and that we cannot speak only about Transombo, or because there are many different types. And now with this excavation, like this one, but others also, now we really understand that there are a lot of things that we don't know, a lot of shape of sheep and types that are completely unknown. And this is a perfect example. So it's about Oreja and this big discussion is now we have to go forward. And of course we have now this example of stern transom, and we have another example in Naples, because in Naples we found two sheep. One is the Napoli C, and this one I think is a transom bow, but okay, we can discuss about this. And the second one is Naples G, and Naples G is a transom stern. And the transom, we have to look to the transom and how this element is within the general structure of the sheep. And not just to say, well, and to look on to these elements, we have to look to the general and show perfectly. And okay, I have so many things, but in Naples C, for example, which is a big, it's not so big, but it's a sailing. We were thinking that it's really a transom bow. Of course, the quality of sailing quality are not extraordinary, but this was a ship used locally in the bay. It has not to have a perfect performance for sailing. And we show that if you put your cargo in the stern part, in the curved part, okay, that we think, it can navigate not so bad. And then we have also to think that the performance for antiquity are not really the same as we think today. Mm-hmm. And this is a small boat, a local use coaster locally and in the harbor too. And has a very, very long life. It was used maybe around 100 years and has a lot of repairs. So it was fitted well for working. And in one moment of his life, they take out the mast, and it was just a pontoon, and just pulled, towed by other ship and used for, we don't know for what, but some working elements. So it's this is one of the consideration that I have. And I would like just to ask you, your transom is vertical, is fitted vertically in the ship. Yeah.
Yes, I think so.
Yeah. And is not so big, is not so thick. No. It's like a plank. Is done by one piece or more than one?
I think one piece, I think.
Yeah.
And all of the planking is actually really quite fine.
In Toulon, we have two ship with the transom. In that case, again, is a transom bow. But is a huge piece. Mm-hmm. And is small in respect of the ship because it's very large. And this is put in high in the when you reconstruct the shape, it's not at the level of the floating, it's at water level, is a little bit higher. So it's different shape, completely different type of boat. But it's interesting. So thank you very much, Ian.
Thank you, Julia.
Yeah.
We've got a question in the chat from Hadley Sharman asking how the team preserved the ship in situ. And then we've got a question from David Blackman. But let's take Hadley's question first. Did you simply cover it back up again or what?
Yeah. It's just been reburied. You know, carefully, obviously, but reburied.
Yeah. Okay.
And if we obviously want to go back to it, then we know where it is. So.
Sure. Yeah. So question from David Blackman.
Hello. I'm invisible, but that's the host's decision, I think.
I can make you visible.
No, it's okay.
You can.
It's better if I'm invisible for this purpose. Yeah. It was good to see Julia was there because I was going to say I thought Naples was really the only other site that we had. And that was good to hear from her. I don't know whether you've had recent comments from Greg Vitruba on the anchor, but
I passed everything about the anchor by Greg.
Right. The transom bow, I find this difficult. If everybody is pointing out that this seems a very odd thing way round, is there any evidence that of the transom being the front end, if you see what I mean?
There is for certain ships, yes, or certain boats, simply because, you know, as Julia was saying, one of them from Naples seems to have a transom bow, and it is so that it can get right up, sort of nose on to the dock side to help in unloading it. So I absolutely think that there are both boats and ships with transom bows and transom sterns. And, you know, that's just how they were built.
Yes, clearly the transom enables the ship to come right flush to the quayside. But you could have, if it was much more difficult to row with the transom at the front, you could always swing it round as you came into the quayside. But
well, the ones from Naples seem to be specifically designed like that.
That's the one.
Because they're quite large vessels themselves. So, I mean, they are just for transporting ships around. They're sort of like lighters as well. So it is a specific design feature on some of them.
Interesting. Thank you.
Thank you, David.
Further questions? Yes, it might be Frank hiding behind the acronym IEASM. Please unmute yourself and speak. It is Frank.
Yes.
Hello.
Thank you.
Good evening, Frank.
Thank you for your excellent presentation. I think we can also say that as the island of Antirrhodos has been struck by an earthquake around 50 AD, we could refine, of course, the datation of that shipwreck as most probably such a service boat, I would say, a tender. Such a tender would have not been allowed in a rural port for a freighter before that date, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I absolutely think so. So I think that the interesting thing is is what it helps us to talk about it in the terms of the transition of the harbour from being the royal port to being this kind of commercial part of the bigger emporium, isn't it?
Yes, and that small port, which used to be a royal port, of course, has a very narrow entrance and the facility were not for such very big freighters as mentioned in the fleet going to Ostia, of course.
Yeah. So within that, then it is the necessity of having the small boats either as tugboats to move them into place, or I also wanted to talk to you about warping the ships around the harbour as well at some point.
Damien, thank you again for a really clear, fascinating and insightful talk.
Thank you very much. And thank you very much to everybody else for watching.